Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. We're quite possessive. He joins us weekly, the films, The Booksellers, What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael. Hi, David.
Hi, Joe. How are you doing this week?
Won't complain. That's my new line.
Okay, well, I hope you have no reason to complain.
Well, that's pushing
but
it.
But in any case, we're grateful to you for not complaining. I won't complain either. We've got a couple of pretty good movies this week. Not great movies, but pretty good. And they are both documentaries, or as some people prefer to say, nonfiction films. And the first one, which is called The Booksellers, is about, you guessed it, booksellers. It's a movie made by one D.W. Young, and it is just a look at people in New York City primarily who deal in rare books, unusual books, hard to find books, hard to get books, and in many cases, unbelievably valuable books. One of the things that comes up in this movie is at one point somebody comments on the difference between something being rare and something being scarce. When something is scarce, it means that there just isn't much of it. When something is rare, it means that not only is there not much of it, but that it is also valuable in one way or another. So this is a movie that deals very much, well, I should say for the most part, with things that are actually rare. Things like, for example, Gutenberg Bibles, where there aren't very many of them, and there are very good reasons for wanting to get your hands on one of these things, not only because they're scarce. Sometimes, especially in the later part of the movie, it sort of slides over into the area of things that don't appear to me to be either rare or particularly scarce. A lot of people who deal in rare books sometimes get, especially younger people, sometimes slide over in the direction of things like ephemera, things like fanzines and posters and things like that. And so in the later part of the movie, it gets away from the area of things where things are really precious as well as being scarce. But much of The Booksellers deals with things that are both of those two things. Deals with things that, and I mentioned Gutenberg Bibles, which is of course a real cliche, but there are all kinds of other books which are extremely precious in all kinds of different ways. So that is what The Booksellers deals with. And what it does is give a series of profiles of people. And it's not just one after another. They kind of jumps around and intermingles them a bit. But basically profiles of people who deal in rare books, how they got into this area of enterprise, why they stayed in it, why some of them really enjoy it a lot and love it a lot, why some of the others have found it to be something of a burden. And one thing that really comes across very clearly, and which I think is kind of interesting, is the idea that as one person who is very much in the business, that has been in the business for a long time and who really loves the business points out, it's a really hard business to be in. For one thing, and I hadn't really thought about this much before, but when you deal in books of any kind, they're big, they're heavy. It's not like dealing in things that we're so accustomed to nowadays in the digital world. They're real objects, and some of these booksellers have got warehouses or even just kind of offices and show places which are just overladen with books, gigantic shelves groaning under the weight of all these books. We hear about one bookseller who had to have spend a fortune on structural reinforcement of an office just because the books weighed so much, and about how somebody says when you go to a book fair, you can spot the book dealers because they're the ones who are sort of walking all crooked up and down the aisles. Their bodies have been skewed and broken and bent by all these years of lugging books around. And I thought all that was kind of interesting. So anyway, The Booksellers is very much about that line of work, that line of activity. And it's a good movie. It's a fun movie. It's an interesting movie to look at. The problem with it is a couple of problems. Number one, people are not identified very well. So you see all these people, and some of them are very famous, like Fran Lebowitz, but some of them are not famous at all. And you kind of wonder, who is this person? Who is that person? Why are these different people talking to us? Are they really important, or are they just people who the filmmaker thought were colorful? So that was one problem. And another thing is that it is very much in the modern style of documentary, where the editing is really fast. And every once in a while, there will be some really fascinating artifact on the screen, and you get really interested in looking at it, and you want to see more of it and see it from different angles and get closer views of it, and it's gone. It's up there for a few seconds, and then it's just gone. And then we're on to the next thing. So that's a problem with the way that films generally these days, including documentaries, are edited. And I wish that the film moved along at a more leisurely pace. After all, the love of books, I think, demands and requires and solicits a certain kind of leisure, and the movie just sort of barrels along at too rapid a pace, and that's a problem with it. But all of those little complaints, enjoyable movie, and if you love books, or if you even just like books a lot, it's a really fascinating look, at least at some points, at that line of work and why people go into it. And some of them have been in it for decades, and some of them are really sure that they really want their books to stay together after they're gone. And other people say, oh, you know, I'm just doing this, and when I'm gone, it doesn't really matter what happens to my books. And that's a kind of a little kind of a fillip that comes at the end of the film, and is another kind of a poignant idea. When you collect books and deal in books all of your life, how do you feel about it when your life starts to come toward its end and people turn out to have different views of that? That's just another little sidelight of the movie that I found interesting. So The Booksellers, not a great documentary, but a good documentary. The other movie, What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael, is very much about the extremely famous, controversial, in some circles notorious, film critic Pauline Kael. Well, you can't have too many movies about film critics, that's what I say. And I certainly knew Pauline back during the active part of her career. Eventually, her various health problems caught up with her, and she retired sometime before the end of her life, although she did die several years ago. But I knew her, and she was a very nice woman, in my opinion. But what I was not was, something that the movie deals with, I was not a Paulette. Pauline Kael famously had a circle of critics who she would call up on the phone and talk to and kind of organize them into little crusades that were meant to support her taste for or against a particular movie. Well, I was never one of those, I can say. And some of the people who have been one of those, who were one of those during her lifetime, appear to be sort of proud of it. And at least one of them appears in the – well, a couple of – actually, I should say at least a couple of them appear in the movie, and they don't always admit to having been Paulettes. But I have to say that that was one part of Pauline's career that made her controversial among critics and among people who kind of knew what was going on in inside circles of her work. And it's something that the movie deals with, although I don't think it really deals with it adequately. So I'm going to back up a little bit now for people who might not be familiar with Pauline Kael. She was one of the movie critics for The New Yorker. Now – before she went to The New Yorker, she was critic for a number of different publications, and she didn't last long, or at least not very long, at any of those places for various reasons. Sometimes they wanted to interfere with what she wrote. Sometimes she just had basically what you might call creative differences with the publication. They were too staid for her, maybe. She loved to be lively and feisty and even vulgar in what she wrote sometimes. Sometimes she just didn't like the idea of the vibe that was in the publication as a whole. Usually it was more that they were unhappy with her than the other way around. But the point is, she went through a number of different publications as she built her career over the years. And one of the things that she discovered is that, at least in her time, it was now I would say even more so, it was very, very hard to make a living as a movie critic. And for a while, there were times in her early career when she despaired of the idea that you could make a living being a movie critic. And that's what she wanted to do. She didn't want to be a writer who was also, you know, who happened to go into the line of movie criticism. She wanted to be a movie critic, and she was that through pretty much her entire career. But that was very important to her. And again, there were times when she really felt that was not possible. Then she settled in at The New Yorker, where she was for about 25 years. And what a lot of people don't realize is that she was only the movie critic for The New Yorker for 6 months out of every year. The other 6 months of the year were handled by Penelope Gilliatt. Penelope Gilliatt never, ever established the kind of presence that Pauline had. In fact, very few critics established the kind of presence presence that Pauline had. She became the really famous one, the one who people were really fascinated with. And yet, the New Yorker kept this arrangement for years and years, and Pauline had to be content with only being a movie critic for half the year. And there, I was very interested to learn this. According to her, at least, she didn't make a living wage being the New Yorker half a year critic. She had to do all kinds of other things, give lectures and give talks and do other things. And one thing that really helped her income a lot was that she published a lot of collections of her reviews. And she was such a terrific writer in so many ways that increased her fame. And of course, it brought her a lot of extra income. At least one of her collections won her the National Book Award. She was a really highly respected writer. Now, about my own opinion about Pauline Kael as a movie critic. For one thing, there was that whole idea of the Paulettes, of her actually organizing this group, this sort of telephone network of movie critics who she would deal with and kind of, again, organize in little crusades for this movie against that movie. I really disapprove of that. And I think that's the kind of thing that gives movie criticism a bad name. There should not be that sort of thing. And she not only was involved in that sort of thing, she was a real sort of ringleader of that sort of thing. And I really disapprove of that. She was, on the other hand, a really interesting writer. And I say interesting rather than terrific, even though in a lot of ways she was terrific, because there were problems with her writing. She had an amazing style. It was very, very punchy, very, very lively. And that's one of the things that made her, to use a real cliche, compulsively readable for a whole lot of people. There were a lot of people who felt that, and I'm not the first person to say this, that reading one of her reviews of a movie was a lot of times better than actually watching the movie. So she was a very lively writer. And again, she didn't mind being, and in fact enjoyed being, coarse and vulgar at times. And that lent a kind of a peppery quality to her criticism that was that made it fun. So all of that was there. On the other hand, and by the way, she was great with parentheses. I'm not sure I can think of any other writer who used parentheses as artfully and often humorously as she did. That said, she had a kind of a bullying style. She used the second person a lot in her writing. You feel this, you feel that. When you come out of this movie, you will be so moved that you won't want to talk about it for a while. You might want to talk, not want to talk about anything for a while because you will be so touched by, you know. So that's a kind of a bullying style, I think. And I always found that one of the least attractive qualities of her prose. And the fact is that sometimes she was flat out wrong. For example, she gave a review of Bernardo Bertolucci's film, Last Tango in Paris. It wasn't just an over-the-top rave review. It was sort of into another stratosphere rave review. She said that the opening of that movie was going to be like the first performance of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring back in 1913. It had that sort of cultural importance. Well, she was wrong about the quality of the movie at the time, and she has certainly been proven wrong about the enduring cultural influence of that movie. So she could be really, really, really wrong. Another fascinating thing is that she had this long, long, long time rivalry with another very great critic, Andrew Saris. Now, Andrew Saris was much more influential on film critics of my generation than Pauline Kael. Pauline Kael's writing was so lively and punchy and spicy that it had a certain influence on film critics of my generation. But Andrew Saris was the one who single-handedly brought the auteur theory, the theory that a director's personality could shape the entire creative language of a movie if that director had a strong enough and powerful enough creative personality. Andrew Saris brought that into American criticism, and nothing has been more influential ever on the history of American film criticism than that idea, which Andrew Saris borrowed from various French critics but brought, again, almost single-handedly to American film criticism back in the 1960s. Well, Pauline wrote an attack on the auteur theory, an attack on Andrew Saris, which in some ways was a pretty personal attack and not a very nice one, a very long time ago. And from that time on, she and Andrew Saris, and I certainly knew Andrew when he was alive as well, had this tremendous sort of personal rivalry between them, because Pauline Kael completely rejected the idea that a director's personality could have anything to do with the quality of a movie. Fascinatingly, she then became herself, in practice, a total auteurist, who would praise almost anything that came from Brian De Palma or Robert Altman or a few other favored movie critics, excuse me, movie directors of hers. So the leader of the great tirade against auteur theory, against directorial personality, became herself a total practitioner of that style of film criticism, which I think gave Andrew Saris a whole lot of private laughs. So all of that is kind of worked out in what she said, The Art of Pauline Kael, and the movie also gives a very nice little profile of Pauline's personality. It gets across some of what she was actually like. So if you're interested in film criticism, you're not going to want to miss this movie, which, by the way, is streaming and pretty easy to get a hold of now. People who don't care anything about film criticism, they still enjoy it as the profile of a really punchy, creative woman who really made her mark in a field which has always been pretty much dominated by men. And for that, among other things, I will always respect Pauline Kael. And that is my non-fictional story this week, Jill.
For which we thank you. As ever, David Stern, Films in Focus, the films, the booksellers, and What She Said, The Art of Pauline Kael.